Good morning, everyone.
Hope you guys all had a great weekend. We have today and then Wednesday, and then don't forget you have your final. You have your second midterm on Friday. I'll have all the blue books as always, and I put the study guide up on the website yesterday. So hopefully you had a chance to see that. If you haven't yet, make sure that you go to that and check that out. I've got four questions. Two of those were here. So look at those, and we can talk about them on Wednesday. And we'll do a little bit of review on Wednesday. So trying to tie some things together. So we've ended the American Civil War, at least we've gotten through much of it by Friday. And I want to pick up just this time period that we have. It's relatively brief, but it's a very influential time period. We don't have a lot on it in the reader, just a little bit. And much of what we do have is written after the time period. But the time period that we have briefly after, and actually somewhat during, the American Civil War, we call Reconstruction. And it's one of the odder time periods in history. It's pretty difficult, actually, to disentangle, because there's just so much going on. But it starts roughly about 1863, and it ends officially in 1877. So what we generally think when we look at this time period is essentially nothing less than pure political corruption. And this is really the only word that we can identify with these years. But there is something else that happens as well, and they're probably tied together. But we also start seeing the rise of American nationalism, and what the nation state is, and an attempt to kind of think about the nation state. So this is where we'll start getting into questions of states' rights versus nation. So let me give you just a couple of points here as we're thinking about this. So we're going to turn to a reading that you have on page 533. I haven't assigned it yet, but we're going to go through it by a very famous classicist, a Southern officer who's trying to re-argue the war through the perspective of classical history. We'll see how effective he is. I would assume that we'll probably all be taken with his writing, and none of us will like his argument, but that's okay. That's kind of the way it should go, I think. But we'll look at it here in just a moment. So a couple of things to think about as we're looking at Reconstruction. So at the end of the American Civil War, you generally have a situation in which Americans are fairly satisfied with the way the war went. Now, that sounds strange, because obviously if you're Southerner, you've lost. But because there were so many ideas of manhood that went into the war itself, and because so many people were volunteer, at the end of the war, it was pretty much acceptable just to say, we both fought the good fight, everything's done, and everyone pretty much just go home. So the moment that Lee surrenders, of course, we talked about this just briefly on Friday, but the moment Lee surrenders, almost immediately after that, we have all of the armies being sent back home. So this is a very unusual situation where the moment the battle's done, you just go home, it's over. And usually you shake hands, you salute one another, you congratulate one another on good job, you think about the meaning of brotherhood and nationhood, and you go. So throughout the entire summer of 1865, we've got soldiers walking home. Nobody's given anything like a train pass or anything like that. The government doesn't have money for that. You just walk home. So all of that summer, the highways, the roads, the dirtways, everything are just packed with soldiers going home. And it takes them 2 to 3 months to get home, to walk back, especially, you can imagine, if you're a soldier from Oregon, it would take quite a while to get back all the way, and generally you walked, unless you could hitch a ride or a train would be kind enough to give you a ride part of the way, but generally you just walked. And for the most part, even Southerners were pretty content that they had fought the good fight and they had lost. So there was still that gentleman's attitude at the end of the war, that as long as they had done what they were supposed to have done, there's no shame in having lost. This was, as they saw it, the judgment of God. God had ruled, the war was over, and things were pretty even. So we often think about the post-war as a very bitter moment. It becomes bitter about 10 years after the war, far more than it is immediately after the war. So immediately after the war, people are pretty content, and we have to ask why. I kind of hinted at this the other day, because it is strange. It's unique in world history. But we can say that for the most part,
There are three things that allow soldiers to kind of just go home and reintegrate into life. The first, and some of this is probably my own bias as Brad, some of this I think is objective, but it's hard for me to distinguish which is Brad, which is objective. So number one, I think importantly, almost everybody North and South was deeply religious and generally Orthodox. So what we find after the war is that the Southerners have no real guilt. They fought for what they thought was right, that is, for a better republic. Northerners felt the same way. They all go back to thinking that their God has ruled and this is the decision that's been made. And generally, people accept providence. They believe that providence has shown his hand and therefore it's over. But the second thing that we have that I think is very important, which is related incidentally to the first part, but almost everybody who fought in the Civil War believed in what they were doing. So there are very few draftees, there are very few people who were forced to do this. Almost everybody on both sides thought that this was a worthwhile battle. They had thrown in their lot, and they had either won or lost. This is what men do. It's a duel. It's a huge, huge duel. And either won or lost, gentlemen accept either their win or their loss, and they go home. But the third thing that probably would be the most controversial in a lot of areas today is simply that almost everybody went home, and they went back to farming. And so it wasn't as though they were getting out of the war and going off to some dark, dank factory where they're doing the same boring thing one moment after another. Instead, this was generally people going home to their farms where they have to get up with the sun and they have to go to bed with the sun, where they are constantly exerting themselves physically. And I think this makes a huge difference in terms of how a society can survive. Because we find that, you know, even in their diaries, people will talk about how it seemed as though they had just spent 4 years waging war. Now they're waging war against the corn and the bugs and everything else. And you actually have that kind of writing in diaries. And there does seem to be just a kind of almost weirdly easy transition from war life to agricultural life. And we find that at the end of the American Civil War, very, very few people have gone into asylums. Very few people are addicted to opium or anything else. In general, they seem to have readjusted to society in ways far better than people in the 20th century have done. And you could say, well, warfare in the 20th century has been worse. That's not quite true. I mean, there's no doubt that warfare in the 20th century has been a bit bloodier, but the Civil War was intensely bloody. So it got a lot of limbs coming off, we got a lot of heads blowing up, we got a lot of friends being lost. So to say that it's less bloody is probably not quite accurate. It may be different in intensity, but still the bloodiness is there. And I don't think that being, for example, at Antietam in 1862 would have been that different than being on the beaches of Normandy in 1944. I think they would have been fairly similar experiences. So there's a lot going on here that we can say, all right, these people are going through the same thing, but they seem to have come out of it in a slightly different way. But what changes everything and really allows a kind of bitterness to develop between the North and the South that lingers to a certain extent to this day is the assassination of Lincoln. Nothing else can make the war as personal. So as long as Chris and I went onto the battlefield as volunteers and as men, we recognize one another as being born in the blood that we shed, even if we're on different sides. But the moment John Wilkes Booth assassinates Abraham Lincoln and does it from behind, it makes this conflict intensely personal. So in a way that it was never personal before, now you have a man, whatever his guilt or innocence, he has not been given the chance to defend himself. He was shot with his wife. She was okay, but he was shot next to his wife in the back, and there was no possibility he could have defended himself. And from every perspective, Northern, Southern, that's just evil. You cannot confront a man in that way. This is just what an animal or a con man would do. So you can't allow. It would be one thing if Wilkes Booth had jumped into the theater and challenged Lincoln to a duel. That actually would have been far more acceptable. But for him just to shoot him in the back, and then for Lincoln to have no chance to defend himself, it's just unacceptable. And it's this, probably more than anything else, that polarizes the North in particular. So once this happens,
the North will rally around the image of Lincoln. Lincoln, by the way, was never ever popular up to this point. Lincoln was, there were a set of people who respected him, but for the most part, during his presidency, he had had to make one terrible decision after another, and he was constantly losing support because of this. And even where you do have moments of intense support for Lincoln, such as immediately before the 1864 election, where he's probably at his height of popularity, he hadn't been in July, but in August he was, it's almost strictly because William Tecumseh Sherman had taken Atlanta. So this, it wasn't Lincoln who had done it, it was his officers. So, Catherine, I'm sorry, you had
been president.
Okay, you sure?
Yes.
Okay, so Lincoln had never been very popular, and it tends to be the case. Now, this is, we've had four presidents assassinated. Two we kind of forget about. The other two we love. So I don't want to suggest that an assassination automatically makes you a great president. But it's the same thing with John F. Kennedy. He was a wretched president. I actually think, well, he had some good ideas overall, but he was a wretched person, and he was a wretched president. But nobody remembers him that way because he died, and he died on film, and there are just too many. And my mother, who's a diehard libertarian, still has a fondness in her heart for John F. Kennedy because he was killed. And so you know, that idea, and still she's still got her Life magazine that she's kept since 1963 of his assassination. Even though she never voted for the guy, there's something about that death that just hit America so hard. And if you read Stephen King, the guy's obsessed with the Kennedy assassination. He comes up in every novel. So, I mean, there's just something about that generation. I was negative four at that point, so I had no recollection of it. But it meant a lot to people. And the same thing is true with Lincoln. Lincoln almost immediately skyrockets into martyrdom status because of this. There were questions, though. Imagine, you know, Lincoln, not only had he had a very rough president, but, and we all have to put ourselves in the Protestant shoes of the 19th century, Lincoln was at the theater, which was automatically regarded as suspect in the 19th century by Protestants. Right? We talked about that when we talked about the Calvinists. So that was already worrisome. But he was there on Good Friday. That's even weirder. So why would you go to the theater? And why would you go to the theater on Good Friday? That's like the lowest of the lowest class people would do something like that. So there was something that was very suspect about Lincoln, and yet the fact that he then dies on Holy Saturday skyrockets him into a Christ-like figure as well. And what happens at this point, and this is one of those weird things in history you could never really explain except just purely by political manipulation, almost all the people in Lincoln's own party who despised him, and I do mean they absolutely hated him, they were called radical Republicans. And they all thought Lincoln was a wimp and a moderate. And they were led by a guy from Ohio, who was one of the nastiest guys ever in U.S. history, a guy by the name of Ben Wade. And Wade had a party when Lincoln was assassinated. He and his friends got together and then toasted the death of Lincoln. They were so excited. Because now they knew the man they hated, they could turn into a symbol. And that symbol could be used to crush the South in Reconstruction. So if you remember Lincoln, when we talked about him, his vision of the post-war world was absolutely no punishment for anyone, complete amnesty for all people. No trials, don't drag this thing out, don't take away property except for slavery. All of this is to just simply go back to the country as it was, with the exception of the 13th Amendment ending slavery. So that was his vision. That was the vision of Grant and Sherman as well. So if you guys remember, we talked just a little bit about this. For Grant, Sherman, and Lincoln, you wage the war as hard as you can. There, you never hold back. You be as brutal as you need. But the moment the war is over, it's totally over. You now have to be as soft in your peace and as kind to the widow as you were brutal during the war. So that may seem strange to us, but that was their vision, absolute amnesty. The radicals hated this. They wanted to punish the South in no uncertain terms. So what Ben Wade and Thaddeus Stevens and others, Charles Sumner, what they did was they intentionally took the martyrdom of Lincoln, whom they hated. They hated Lincoln, but they took that martyrdom and they made it this grand thing. that they could then impose their political agenda on everyone. So they create out of this, and they do this very intentionally, they embalm Lincoln in his glass case, and they move the body throughout the entire North, and they intentionally go to the cities that had the most pro-Republican leanings. And this is all political manipulation. And it was a way to make a Christ figure out of Lincoln through all of this. And that's their way that they can impose their will upon the South afterwards. Morgan.
If they knew that the radical Republicans hated Lincoln, then why did they give him the body?
Well, they were charged, basically. So they're the radical Republicans that control Congress. They had, there's a long history behind this. It's a great question, Morgan. There's a long history behind this. In the fall of 1861, there had been this weird maneuver that was done by the U.S. Army against the Confederates in a place called Ball's Bluff outside on the Potomac in Washington. And it was a trap from the beginning. The Confederates knew where they were going. And so Ben Wade creates a committee. Then afterwards, this was October 21st of 1861, he creates a committee called the Joint Committee on the Conduct of the War. So it was both in the Senate and the House, and they had powers. They gave themselves judicial powers. They could try any officer. They could throw officers that they deemed un-American in prison without trial. I mean, they had their show trial, and people just disappeared. It was like Soviet. It was very creepy. So they had been using this power all along throughout the war, and they tried to always fight Lincoln, but they really did control Congress. It was one reason Lincoln never had the support of Congress, because they thought he was too wimpy overall. So these guys were hardcore. And imagine, in 1861, when all the Southerners leave, there's no opposition. The Republicans are now, even where before they were splitting votes, they're totally in charge now. They can do whatever they want. Nobody can harm them at all. So they've gone from a situation where they're not a minority, but basically kind of half and half, to just ruling everything. So does that make sense? Okay. But yeah, Lincoln was just way too moderate for them. But now they can use him as a symbol, and they do. So this is called, and because you need to know this term, this is a term called waving the bloody flag. And it's basically any time you have a campaign speech, and this was, it's pretty smart politics. I don't think it's very good life, but it's good, smart politics. If you were in the middle of a debate and you're a Republican and you're losing the debate, the Democrats beating you, you just suddenly say, oh, by the way, I fought with the 24th Ohio. What about you? It was like, at that point, you just can't. I mean, this would go on for 30 years after the war. There's nothing you can say at that point. You've lost every debate the moment someone claims the bloody flag. So this was all part of what they were doing. And, of course, look at, if any of you study political history, the Republicans, of course, I think they're a better party than the Democrats, but the Republicans control Congress and the presidency all the way up until basically 1930. Yeah, the only two presidents that we have are Wilson and Grover Cleveland during that entire time. It's a half century of just Republican presidents, except for those other two. That's amazing. And that's coming out of how they solidify their position after this. So there's a lot of corruption. And for me, this is very hard, because the Civil War is terrible, of course, but it's so noble. And you just immediately turn from this incredible, clear-cut, black and white, good, evil, to just a horrible, confusing mess of just corruption and political infighting. And it really is. It's a dreadful period in American history. But I do want you to keep that in mind. So there's a lot of things going on in terms of this corruption and what the corruption can mean. So the other big thing, though, and this is a great thing, but it complicates American history. Remember, one of the reasons that the Civil War became a war that it did was to end slavery. And that's incredible. So if we start off the American population in 1861 at 30 million, remember, out of those 30 million are 4.25 million blacks. And that's a huge percentage of the population that's enslaved. And remember, in the South, it's only about 11 million total. And out of that 11 million, that's the 4.25 million. So almost half, not quite half, but over a third of the Southern population are enslaved blacks. Now in 1865, you have this amazing moment where 4 million people are suddenly free. And that
is an amazing moment in terms of the history of liberty, but in the terms of reality, that's incredibly difficult. You know, imagine, what do you do with these people who have never known freedom? They make up a huge percentage of your population. You have to be racist in the least. They could be green, they could be purple. Doesn't matter. It happens to be the fact that they were black and enslaved. But now you've got all these people who are suddenly free. And out of this, and this is, to me, this is a great success story, but it's not the success story that I think a lot of people like to see it as in the modern world. If we go forward, and we look just at a couple of statistics here, in 1865, literacy among black Americans, understandably, was very low. It was generally illegal to teach blacks to read and write in the South. They could go and have religion, but anything beyond that was deemed really untrustworthy, or at least there was worriedness that went with that. So in 1865, the literacy rate among blacks was only about 5%, which we're talking 95 out of every 100 blacks simply cannot read a single word. At best, they can maybe sign an X. And even then, not likely, because, of course, they wouldn't be signing contracts unless they were doing some kind of piecemeal work. So literacy was only about 5%. By the time, however, you jump to 1910, now, that's a good period of time. We're talking a half century there, 45 years, so basically three generations later. By the time we get to 1910, literacy among blacks is roughly around 90%. Now, there's no one in the world, no one, no people anywhere that has ever become that literate that quickly. And that's astounding to think about that. And why does that happen? And here's where this is not going to jibe with the kind of modern political correctness, but it's just simply a fact. Very few of these blacks were being taught by whites. Almost all of the blacks who learned to read and write were being taught by other blacks. And that's astounding to think about that. So you've got about 5% of the population that's teaching everybody else. You do have, and I know you guys have all heard stories about the carpetbaggers and so forth who go south. And you do have northern teachers who go down. But for the most part, because of the segregation laws, it wasn't allowed for whites to be educating blacks. So my point with this, and I certainly would not argue in favor of segregation, but what we find during the segregation of the late 1800s and the early 1900s, is that regardless of what it was like morally in terms of whether segregation was right or not, it did work in the sense that blacks being left alone, for the most part, were able, being left alone, to enjoy everything freedom had to offer. Now, that doesn't mean they were going to rise in society. Black communities had to stay as black communities. But within those black communities, which grew mightily after the Civil War, you have great literature, like Zora Neale Hurston comes out of this, some of the finest literature ever written in American history. You have physicians, you have scientists, Booker T. Washington, George Carver. I mean, there's an amazing renaissance among black Americans during this time, despite all the disadvantages they suffer. And believe me, I'm not advocating for suffering, but there's no doubt that in the face of that adversity, black culture was incredibly admirable. And I'll give you another statistic that is just absolutely jaw-dropping. Now, today, among families, we know that the divorce rate among whites is just slightly lower than the divorce rate among blacks. Or it's better now because we don't even have that many divorces anymore because people just aren't marrying. But if you look at the statistics of what percentage of children are born out of wedlock versus those born within wedlock, it's now about the same between whites and blacks. In the 1950s, it was completely inverted, where you had very, very high rates of childbirth outside of marriage in the black community and very rarely in the white community. That's about even. But here's an amazing thing. In 1910, in the white community in 1910, so if we're talking just kids born out of wedlock, actually, I'll put it the other way, kids born into a marriage. If we look at it, in 1910, among whites, only about 82% of kids, and it's still really high, but only about 82% of kids are born into a white family that is born into a family with two parents in the family. Whereas in the black community in 1910, it was about 92% were born into a two-parent family. So a lot of what we know about the breakdown of the family in the 20th century has absolutely nothing, not a single thing to do with race. Not a single thing. If it did have to do with race, you could never explain a 92% marriage rate in 1910. It doesn't make any sense. So there are other factors that have to be involved in the breakdown of marriage. And we'll talk about what that is. But I just want you to know statistically, it's not one of those things where we tend to think the black experience has just gone from bad to worse. That is not the case at all. It has always been bad simply because of the oppression in society. But within that badness, there have been incredible moments of success, amazing moments that are beyond actually calculation. And that happened very strongly in the 19-aughts and the 19-teens. Shiloh.
Is there a possible correlation between the fact that so many white aristocrats or like rich people were having affairs with black women, and that could account for some of like the lower rates of marriage of families?
It did prior to slavery, right? I mean, prior to the end of slavery. So yes, absolutely. Prior to the Civil War, that was always a huge factor. And that meant, of course, that, you know, imagine if you're in a society where marriage is completely at the will of someone else. So even if we're black and we're married, at any point, our slave master could sell one of us off. And that means that marriage becomes, of course, no matter what, completely untenable in the sense of you never know how permanent it is. So one of the things that is fascinating that develops in black culture is a matriarchy. And so within black slave culture, whoever the oldest woman is, and usually was given titles like Big Mama was a very common title during the slavery period, she became the matriarch. And that was very different than in white society where you have a patriarchy. But in black society, it became very important to have a stable, elderly woman who kind of ran everything. But what's interesting to me, at least, is you would expect that to continue. That actually does not continue, but it does resurface with the breakdown of the family in the 1950s. You'll see the reassertion of women in black culture in terms of being able to determine family structure. But from about the Civil War up until the 1950s, blacks reverted to a very normal two-parent household during that time. Does that help?
Yeah.
Or make sense? So I don't have answers for all this. I wish I did. I find it absolutely fascinating. But it will, I think, I'd like you guys to at least keep it in mind, because we'll talk a lot about the black experience when we get into the 1950s and 60s. That's obviously in the next section of the course, in the final section. But we will get back to that. But I want you to at least keep this in mind. Shiloh, that's a great question, so thank you. Okay, anything else on this? All right, one other thing I want to state, and this may seem counterintuitive, but every time we see a Jim Crow law being passed, you guys all know what a Jim Crow law is, right? A law that either promotes segregation among whites and blacks, or it is very anti-black. In a sense, in a very perverted sense, you can consider that a success for black culture. And the reason I say that is because the only reason laws are ever passed is because there is a response to success within black culture. That means whites are upset and they're jealous. So anytime you see a law that says, oh, blacks may have to pay this extra tax, the reason that happens is because whites are worried about the competition. And that means in a perverted way, blacks have done incredibly well. Does that make sense for everyone? I realize it's counterintuitive. But, and I'm not saying this is a good thing. It's a terrible thing. But you have to realize, too, that there's a weird history going on here in which there are successes, not just failures. Okay, good. So let's turn, what we're going to do now that I've probably totally corrupted your mind in terms of showing you how evil this Reconstruction time period is, we're going to look to this guy, Basil Gildersleeve. So this is on page 533. And this is the other thing that I want to mention today. And then we'll finish things off on Wednesday. But this is also a strange kind of history that I think probably still needs to be explored. Scholars have not done enough with it. If you remember, going into the American Civil War, what did most aristocrats in the South do? Think about William Byrd. You guys have the Diary of William Byrd. They drink,
they play cards, they womanize. Yeah, and that's not always the case, but of course that was generally the case. And how educated was William Byrd? He's incredibly educated. So what do you do at the end of the Civil War where you've got all of these incredibly educated, liberally educated aristocrats who now have no place in society? They have no place. Nobody's going to hire them. They wouldn't even know how to work because they've had slave labor all of their lives. What they know is they know how to read and they know how to write. So what happens that's just bizarre and fascinating all at the same time, there's really only one place for these aristocrats to go. They go into the universities. And so our university system, strangely, at the same time all of our primary and secondary education is being Yankified, right, where you've got everything is becoming essentially the Massachusetts model of education, now public education. So we're starting to see the rise after the Civil War, what we'll call public, soon it will be called progressive, but we have public education. At that same time, we also have all these ex-Confederates who are going into academia, because they really can't do anything else. I hate to say that, obviously, in academia. So I guess there's probably not much else I could do in real life. So thank God, you know, I've got this job. But, and I'm sure you've all met professors who are like that. You just know they would never, you know, they'd be pumping gas somewhere. So you've got all of this rise of public education, but at the same time, so all of this is being made very Yankee. The universities are being made extremely pro-Southern. So in the universities. And a lot of these guys, because they're classically trained, they start reimagining the American Civil War as a war that was essentially the recreation of the fight between Sparta and Athens. They start thinking of this as the great Greek conflict. And they write about it in that way. And that's not totally unacceptable. Remember Lincoln and his Gettysburg Address, the Pericles funeral oration. So this is not just a Southern thing. He was also very Northern. But now these Southerners go in. And they very, I don't want to say this is conspiratorial, because you would understand why they're doing this, but the Southerners are the very first to write the history of the Civil War. And they write history after history after history of the Civil War. And what they do in these histories, again, understandably, I think they're wrong, but you can understand why they would do this, they write the histories from a very pro-Southern standpoint. And the South becomes, between about 1866 in 1877, the South becomes that noble place that is now a part of the lost cause. This is the language they use. It's the lost cause. So just as King Arthur stood and fought the good fight and then had to go back to sleep for thousands of years until he's needed again, so with the Confederacy. The Confederacy fought the good fight, not for slavery, that's not what they say, they fought for states' rights. And they fought for a proper understanding of the Constitution. And that's the history that gets written. Yes, our guest, what's your name?
Jillian,
thanks. It's great.
I was wondering, is that like kind of the origin, and this may be like controversial, why some people still hold like the Confederate flag dearly?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is all part, this is a great question, Jillian, because this is exactly it. This is where everybody starts promoting that. This is the lost cause. And it's not just at the elite. You're going to have it with the university professors, but you're also going to start seeing a rise among just average citizens in the South, too. And especially, you can imagine who was at worst, the young people who knew what their fathers did, but didn't actually see the war. They're the ones who gravitate towards the lost cause and start romanticizing it more than anyone else. That's a great question. Where are you from?
Mundelein, Illinois.
All right. Glad. Oh, that's, yeah, Libertyville.
Yeah,
glad you're here. That's great. Okay, so all of that's going on, and there's this background. So how odd that we come out of this war where the Yankees win, but it doesn't look that way if you're reading the books. And Gildersleeve, who is really a pretty cool guy, despite the fact that I disagree with his Southern politics, he was a genius. And he was regarded by far as one of the single greatest professors of the late 19th century. And any of you who are classics majors or have taken classics here, you've all been influenced by Gildersleeve's thought, because Gildersleeve was the leading classicist of the 19th century. So even if he's not cited directly, he's there.
and he's all over the place. Now, there are northern counterparts to this, too. One of the great northern generals, one of my favorite men of the Civil War, was Professor Joshua Chamberlain, who was also a classicist, and he was a professor at Bowdoin College. But after the war, he went back and was president of Bowdoin College, and then he became governor of Maine. So he went into politics. You can't do that in the South, because the Confederates, they're done. Right? They could get back into politics, because it's going to be very hard for them. So academia is where they go. So let's read Gildersleeve, who was, he did fight in the Civil War, and he was a relatively young man, not incredibly young, but he was in his late 20s, early 30s. And anybody want to read? We'll just start right at the beginning. Yeah, thanks. Just start right at the beginning there. What was all true Confederates beyond question a holy cause?
What was to all true Confederates beyond a question a holy cause, the holiest of causes, this fight in defense of the sacred soil of our native land, was to the other side a wicked rebellion and damnable treason. And both parties to the quarrel were not sparing of epithets which, at this distance of time, may seem to our children unnecessarily undignified. And no doubt some of these epitheta ornantia continue to flourish in remote regions, just as pictorial representations of Yankees and rebels in all their respective fiendishness are so cherished here and there. At the Centennial Exposition of 1876, the way of conciliating the section, the place of honor in the art annex, or by whatever un-English name they called it, was given to Rothermel's painting of the Battle of Gettysburg, in which the face of every dying Union soldier is lighted up with a celestial smile, while guilt and despair are stamped on the wan countenances of the moribund rebels. At least such is my recollection of the painting. And I hope that I may be pardoned for a malicious pleasure I felt when I was informed of the high price that the state of Pennsylvania had paid for that work of art. The dominant feeling was amusement, not indignation. But as I looked at it, I recalled another picture of a battle scene, painted by a friend of mine, a French artist, who had watched our life with an artist's eye. One of the figures in the foreground was a dead Confederate boy, lying in the angle of a worm fence. His uniform was worn and ragged, mud-stained as well as blood-stained. The cap which had fallen from his head was a tatter, and the torn shorts were ready to drop from his stiffening feet. Within a buttonhole of his tunic was stuck the inevitable toothbrush, which continued even to the end of the war to be the distinguishing mark of gentle nurture, the souvenir that the Confederates so often received from fair sympathizers in border towns. I am not a realist, but I would not exchange that homely toothbrush in the Confederate's buttonhole for the most angelic smile that Rothermel's brush could have conjured up. Now, I make no doubt that most of the readers of The Atlantic have got beyond the Rothermel stage, and yet I am not certain that all of them appreciate the entire clearness of conscience with which we of the South went into the war. A new patriotism is one of the results of the great conflict, and the power of local patriotism is no longer felt to the same degree. In one of his recent deliverances, Mr. Carnegie, a Canady Scot who has constituted himself the representative of American patriotism, now without profit, says, "The citizen of the Republic today is prouder of being an American than he is of being a native of any state in the country. What it is to be a native of any state in the country, especially an old state with an ancient and honorable history, is something that Mr. Carnegie cannot possibly understand. But that today is superfluous. The Union was a word of power in 1861 as it is in 1891. Before the secession of Virginia, a Virginian Breckinridge asked, if exiled in a foreign land, would the heart turn back to Virginia or South Carolina or New York or to any one state as a cherished home of its pride? No. We would remember only that we were Americans. Surely, this seems quite as patriotic as Mr. Carnegie's utterance, and yet, to the native Virginian just quoted, so much stronger was the state than the central government that, a few weeks after his bold speech, he went into the war and finally perished in the war. A Union man, says his biographer, fighting for the rights of his old mother Virginia, and there were many men of his mind, noted generals, valiant soldiers. The University Memorial, which records the names and lives of the alumni of the University of Virginia who fell in the Confederate War, 200 in number, this volume, full of memories and of sighs, to every Southern man of my age, lies open before me as I write, and some of the noblest men who figure in its pages were Union men. And the memorial of the Virginia Military Institute tells the same story with the same eloquence. The state was imperiled, and parties disappeared. And the combatants in the field, some of the bravest and the most conspicuous, belonged to those whose love of the old Union was warm and strong, to whom the severance of the tie that bound the states together was a personal grief. But even those who prophesied the worst, who predicted a long and bloody struggle and a doubtful result, had no question about the duty of the citizen, shared the common burden and submitted to the individual sacrifice as readily as a various fire eater, nay, as they claimed, more readily. The most intimate friend I ever had, who fell after heroic services, was known by all our circle to be utterly at variance with the prevalent Southern view of the quarrel, and died upholding a right which was not a right to him, except so far as a mandate of his state made it a right. And while he would have preferred to see the old flag floating over a united people, He restored the new banner to its place time after time when it had been cut down by shot and shell.
Okay, that's very well read. Thank you. So let's stop there for a moment. Anyone know the story behind the toothbrush? This is a very common thing that happened to both Northerners and Southerners. Anybody at all? Okay, toothbrushes. This is not our modern toothbrush where you just go and buy the Colgate 3-pack. Right? All toothbrushes were homemade. And so it was always a very simple thing to make. It was wood. I mean, simple. It took time, but anyone could do it. So you just take wood, and then you put bristles on it. And it's just a brush, but it's a toothbrush. And one of the things that Southern boys did that was competition is when they would march through a town, they would have competitions. How many toothbrushes did they get from pretty young women? So that was always, and you wouldn't actually take, unless you thought the woman was pretty, you wouldn't take the toothbrush that was offered to you. It was kind of like, this would have been my grandmother's age, but it was like when you go to a dance, you don't give your, my grandma used to always have all these, she'd put scarves on her. You guys know this old tradition? You put a scarf, and then if you want a man to ask you to dance, you drop the scarf in front of him, and the handkerchief. But it was the same kind of thing, except it was toothbrushes. And the toothbrush became the symbol of really everything. And guys would come out, good-looking guys would come out after going through town with like 10 of these things, and the kind of not-so-good-looking guys would only have one or a broken one or something. And it was definitely, there's all this status and lots of symbol. So that's when he says, I would much rather have walked out of the town with a toothbrush than have some guy paint me in an angelic way. He's making a joke, but at the same time he's saying something very serious. There was more honor to be given to the common soldier simply for doing his duty than hiring this great German portrait painter to idolize somebody. And so he's mocking the North. He also thinks it's funny the state of Pennsylvania paid too much for this piece of art. But I hope you all catch the point he's trying to make. Notice how he brings this in to the argument. So he's in his 60s now. He had he's twice as old as he was during the Civil War. We're now 30 years after the Civil War. And he's writing. Anybody catch what's the magazine he's writing for? It's The Atlantic. There is no greater Yankee magazine than The Atlantic. It was formed to be the ultimate expression of Yankeedom. So now you've got the ultimate Yankee magazine publishing an old Confederate, and that in and of itself is very telling. And what does he say? What's his argument? Why were Southern soldiers fighting? Does he even mention blacks yet? In everything we've read?
It's for their state.
Yeah. Yes, our guest?
It's for their state.
Yeah, absolutely. It's patriotism, right? Everything is patriotism. Everything that they did was simply because they're good Republicans, small R Republicans, like every other American. So he's easing this, and I don't mean to suggest he's being manipulative here. He is a great rhetorician. He's a classicist. He understands how to make an argument. But he's also easing this in, saying, well, look, yeah, why were we fighting? Well, gosh, we're doing the same thing you guys were doing. And there is a truth in that. This is what we talked about last week. There's a very serious truth in that. But he's also easing us into the argument. So here's where I, as an academic and someone who loves liberal arts, kind of cringe. What happens, as I've already said, we've got all these Southerners who are now teaching at liberal arts colleges everywhere. But it's also recognized that that's not necessarily a good thing, to have all these Southerners teaching this. So we start seeing an alternative form of education arise in the United States. And that alternative education is progressive education, which comes out of the German universities. And you do have a few Southerners who go over and study with the Germans, but it's mostly people from Wisconsin or from Michigan who go over and study in German universities. We'll talk more about this later, but the very fact I have a PhD is all the result of us adopting a German system. And you couldn't even get a job at Hillsdale anymore in any way, shape, or form without a PhD. You're done. And that's transformed dramatically in just 100 years, even in a place like Hillsdale, which is gung-ho in favor of the traditional liberal arts. Even we have, and I understand there's no other way to get around it, but even we have completely bought into the idea that only a PhD should be tenured here. And that tells you something, that this, and it's a German invention, that you have this thing. And partly is you're trying to supersede these liberal arts guys, yeah, who probably only have what would be considered a master's. Now you can have this scientific study in philosophy as opposed to just a general study in wisdom. Now it's knowledge. We're going to get into all of that. But I hope you understand this is one of the major moments in American intellectual history, because we're now going to transition away from the liberal arts very quickly, in large part because the liberal arts are seen, not incorrectly in America, as a way to defend Southern thinking. Not totally incorrect, unfortunately. It doesn't have to be that way, but historically, that's the way it developed. Okay, so let's read just a little bit more. We've only got 3 minutes left. Did somebody else want to read at this point just the next paragraph? Yeah, let's do one more paragraph, and we'll call it a day. So, thanks, Catherine.
Those who were bred in the opposite political faith, who read their right of withdrawal in the Constitution, had less heart-searching to begin with than the Union men of the South. But when the state called, there were no parties, and the only trace of the old difference was a certain rivalry which should do the better fighting. This ready response to the call of the state showed very clearly that, despite varying theories of government, the people of the Southern states were practically of one mind as to the seat of the paramount obligation. Adherence to the Union was a matter of sentiment, a matter of interest. Arguments urged from the South against secession were addressed to the memories of the glorious struggle for independence, to the anticipation of the glorious future that awaited the united country, to the difficulties and the burdens of a separate life. A special stress was laid on the last argument, and the expense of a separate government, of a standing army, was set forth in appalling figures. A northern student of the war once said to me, if the southern people had been of a statistical turn, there would have been no secession, there would have been no war. But there were men enough of a statistical turn in the South to warn the people against the enormous expense of independence, just as there are men enough of a statistical turn in Italy to remind Italians of the enormous cost of national unity. Counting the cost is in things temporal the only wise course, as in the building of a tower. So there are times in the life of an individual, of a people, when the things that are eternal force themselves into the calculation, and the abacus is nowhere. Neither count I my life dear unto myself, is a sentiment that does not enter into the domain of statistics. The great Athenian statesman who saw the necessity of the Peloponnesian War was not above statistics, as he showed when he passed in review the resources of the Athenian Empire, the tribute from the allies, the treasure laid up in the house of the Virgin. But when he addressed the people in justification of the war, he based his argument not on a calculation of material resources, but on a simple principle of right. Submission to any encroachment, the least as well as the greatest, on the rights of the state meant slavery. To us, submission meant slavery, as it did to Pericles and the Athenians, as it did to the great historian of Greece, who learned this lesson from the Peloponnesian War, and who took sides with the southern states, to the great dismay of his fellow radicals, who could not see, as George Grote saw, the real point at issue in the controversy. Submission is slavery, and the bitterest taunt in the vocabulary of those who advocated secession was submissionist.
Okay, good job. So, who are we? Well, we were just the good guys who fought on the side of the ancient world. How could you not love us? Right? So there it is, and you can see that argument pretty strongly. Okay, please finish reading this for Wednesday, and the other piece I would like you to read for Wednesday is The Frontier in American History by Frederick Jackson Turner, and that'll be it leading up to your midterms. So don't forget, your midterm's Friday, and then next week Friday, you have the day off, right? We won't have class next week Friday. Okay, so this week, midterm, next week, no class on Friday. All right, thanks everybody. Have a great Monday and Tuesday. Thanks for visiting. Thanks for jumping in, too. You've got some good gumption.
I heard you're a really big Rush fan.
Yeah, my reputation precedes me. Yes, I love Rush.
I've seen them in concert twice.
Oh, nice. So is Katarina here.
Really?
So, yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
My mom is like worshipper.
Very nice.
Yes.
Well, I hope you have a good visit here.
Hey, Chris.
So, again, thank you for being
on. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I definitely will read this afternoon.
And
so,
would you still be willing to talk about face-to-face?
Yeah, what's in tomorrow? Could you do it? I have a lunch at 12:20, but I'm free from 11 to 12:20.
Yeah.
You want to just stop by around 11? My office. Okay, cool. I'll see you then.
Thank you very much. I'll bring back.
Okay, yeah, exactly.
Hey,
thank you.
I was wondering if you had gotten my email.
About?
The essay.
Let me see. What did you ask? I can't remember.
Well,
I kind of stayed off. all weekend.
I've missed about a little over 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah. Right. So
I
you just needed
I
a
I need a little bit of an extension.
No problem at all.
Okay.
No problem. But so, when you turned it in to me, just write on there that you removed that you had already gotten permission.
Okay,
so I remember. Yeah. How are you feeling now?
I'm good. Yeah.
Okay,
it took a while to get better.
Understood.
I was basically sick from the time I got here. At the beginning of the semester, and for 3 weeks.
And it just lingered.
And then I got better. I was better for like 2 weeks, and then I got sick again.
So I'm sorry.
It's been a tough semester.
Understood. Yeah.
But thank
okay,
you.
Cool. Oh, no problem. Anything you need. So, hey, Catherine.
Did you get my email by any chance?
I have not checked it this morning.
Basically, I had a midterm that got pushed to
Friday. I did get that. Okay. Yes, because of your... Yeah. So what did you want to do?
Well, I haven't really had a chance to... study with, okay. with the study guide getting pushed.
So you just want
to
wait until next week?
Would that be possible?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay,
yeah,
so
no
sometime
problem.
Like...
I am out of town on Thursday and Friday next week, so we'll have to do it in the first half
Monday or Tuesday would be fine.
Yeah, just email me over the weekend, this coming weekend, and we'll set something up.
Okay, thank you so much. That helps me a lot. Thank you.
Thanks. So,
hey, Doc, I just want to say sorry for not coming to class today. I had a meeting with the chief, and it went a little longer than I thought it was going to.
No problem at all. Did it go well?
Yeah, it went great.
Good. Were you military?
I hope to be. I went to OCS last summer.
Okay,
so when
cool.
I graduate, I'll
I figured
you'd
be. Yeah.
Quick question. As far as the tests and papers, then,